I'd like to call this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2019. We're at 1:16 p.m. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Deneen Tuck. Thanks, Sophia Tenney, our current House Labor and Commerce Secretary, and Taylor Kelly, the LIO moderator. So at this time, I want to remind everybody to silence your devices. So present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Rivak, Representative Stutes, Representative Tallarico, Representative Fields, Co-Chair Wong, and myself, Co-Chair Ledoux. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have several items on the agenda today. First, this is our fourth hearing on HB 102. Amendments were due in my office no later than 5 p.m. on Friday. No amendments were received. Are there any questions from the committee? Are there any comments from the committee? What is the will of the committee? Representative Stutes.
I think you have a comment over here, Fields.
Okay.
I just wanted to thank my colleague from Fairbanks for introducing this bill to make sure our statutes keep up with evolving technology in the rental car market. Obviously, Airbnb thrives while paying a fair share of local taxes, and I'm sure that these companies can as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Field. Anybody else? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Chair Ledoux. I move House Bill 102, Rental Vehicle by Private Owner, version 31-LS0595/U from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Looking around, seeing no objections, that bill moves from committee. We're going to have a brief at ease.
We're back on the record, picking up a few more bills. Our second item on the agenda is SB 29, Extend Board of Marine Pilots. This is our first hearing. Senator Stebbins is not available, but his staffer, David Scott, is here, and he's at the table. We also have in the room Eileen Donahue, CPA from Legislative Budget and Audit, Sarah Chambers, Division Director for Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, Captain Ed Sinclair, Director of Southeast Alaska Pilots Association and Board Member for the Alaska Marine Pilots, Charles Ward, Marine Pilot Coordinator with the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And online we have Les Kronk, Vice President with Southeast Steve Doring Corporation and Board Member of the Alaska Marine Pilots. And we have Dave Scott at the table. So, Mr. Scott, could you present the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Stedman. He thanks you for scheduling the bill and sends his regards. Senate Finance is meeting right now. The bill in front of the committee, SB 29, extends the Board of Marine Pilots for 8 years, as recommended by the legislative auditor. This board licenses and regulates marine pilots to ensure that they are competent and they're safe. It makes final licensing decisions and takes disciplinary actions against violators of laws and regulations. The board has 7 members. It has 2 marine pilots, 2 agents of vessels, 2 public members, and the Commissioner of Commerce are her designee. As I mentioned, the legislative auditor recently conducted a review of the board and found a continued need in that the board is following the law, processing investigations timely, and actively reviews and changes its regulations to improve the industry and better protect the public. As you mentioned, there's somebody from legislative audit here to help to go over the law audit if the committee so chooses. There is a fiscal note associated with the bill. You'll note, though, that it is funded through receipt-supported services. And as you mentioned, Sarah Chambers, who's the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licenses here, she could go over that. She's the author of that fiscal note. And also, you mentioned Charles Ward's here for questions, and 2 members of the board are available, Les Kronk and Ed Sinclair. And if there's any questions, I could try to answer them or give them to Lifelines.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Scott, my only question has to do with the length of the extension. I'm a freshman, and most of the extensions I've seen have been less than 8 years. So is the Marine Pilots extension for 8 years unique to Marine Pilots? Is there something the statute that guides us to that? Or
through the chair, Representative Hannon, possibly somebody from audit can answer that question fairly better than I, but in my experience here in the building, the longer, 8 years is the longest they you'll ever see one, and it means that the board's really in good standing. There's no real issues with their audit. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If we can get someone to speak to the audit, Sarah Chambers, or who's the audit? Eileen Donahue, I guess, would be the who's online. Eileen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Yeah, could you speak to the audit, please?
Yes, Representative through the chair. Would you like me to do the summary, or did you want me to respond to the question on the maximum 8 years?
Well, you can respond to the question and then give us a summary overview. That'd be great.
Okay. Regarding the recommendation for maximum eight-year extension, we didn't have significant findings for this audit, and so that is our maximum, and that is why we made that decision this year. For the record, my name is Eileen Donahue, Audit Manager with Division of Legislative Audit. I'll go ahead and do a summary of the audit of Board of Marine Pilots Sunset Audit dated April 2018. The audit concludes the board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing Marine pilots and deputy Marine pilots and improving trainees and apprentices. Board meetings were conducted in compliance with laws, investigations were processed timely, and the board actively changed regulations to improve the industry and better protect the public. We recommended the maximum eight-year extension for this board. As of January 2018, there were a total of 103 licensees, as shown on page 12 of the audit report. The exhibit on page 14 shows the board's schedule of revenues and expenditures. As of the end of March 2018, the board had a surplus of just over $229,000. The report included only two recommendations. Recommendation number one, we recommended the Board of Marine Pilots ensure all applicable documents are aboard foreign pleasure craft. Regulations require an operator of a pleasure craft applying for a pilot exemption to ensure the pleasure craft has aboard documents such as nautical charts, current title tables, and other guides. Auditors found five of the seven applications tested indicated that required documents were not on the vessel at the time of the application. It has been standard procedure for the board to approve these exemptions with the understanding that the applicant will follow through and obtain the required documents at a later date. The board did not consider the need nor the importance of verifying that the documents were actually obtained. Additionally, the exemption does not include a stipulation that the applicant obtain the required documents prior to entering the applicable area. Issuing foreign pleasure craft exemptions without verifying required documents or aboard the vessel increases the risk to public safety. On page 16 of the audit report, recommendation number two, we recommend the board ensures the Southeast Alaska Pilots Association improved procedures for tracking drug test notifications. In a sample of nine drug test donors from the association, the audit found three donors notified by mail were not tracked by date and recipient. Therefore, the timeliness of the drug test could not be confirmed by the auditors. In this situation, the association relied on a third-party contractor to notify selected donors that were out of state or out of town. The association was not aware the mail notifications were not adequately tracked. This limits the ability to verify timeliness of drug tests and increases the risk to public safety. The responses to the audit began on page 25 of the report. In this case, both the department and the board agreed with the two recommendations. That concludes my summary of the audit report, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, through the chair. So I have a question about recommendation one. And I'm hoping you can answer it, but that is, if the Marine pilots found a foreign pleasure vessel that was not in compliance with required documents, could they hold the vessel? And would there be a fine or a fee that that foreign vessel would have to do until they had the documents?
Representative, through the chair, it's my understanding that they don't search the vessels after they're already in the water. This is an application that's happening before the vessel gets in our area.
Follow up. So if that foreign vessel could not prove that they had required documentation, then their permission to enter Alaskan waters could be and should be denied. That would be the conclusion of the audit.
Our audit was, through the chair, Representative, our audit was looking at the application process for these exemptions. that at the time of application, before they even get into the waters, there's they indicate on the application if they have these particular items on board. And then the exemptions are granted with the expectation that even if they don't have them at that time, because sometimes they're downloading them through the internet or they obtain them at their first stop, that they will be getting them is the expectation of the board. And we felt that they should have them at the time they're doing the application and not trying to rely that they'll get them at a later date.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none. I have one question and we can go to comments.
Okay.
Let's see. Ms. Donahue, the looks like the board was at a deficit in 2014, but then got as high as 300,000 surplus in 2017, and now at about $250,000 in the bank. Is this usual? It seems kind of high for a board that had $28,000 in travel expenses.
Representative, I can't speak specifically for the travel expenses, but I do know that it changes year to year based on the biannual license renewals. It's happening every other year, so you'll see the swing in the revenues over time. And I do know that at the after it does have a surplus as of March 2018, and after our audit period, the department was going to be evaluating the fees to ensure that they're in line, so that they didn't get excessive surpluses.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it seems like they went from it climbed from 100 to 300, and I understand the off-year fluctuation, but it looks like they have a fair amount of cash on hand, so I guess you could look at fees, which it sounds like you are. Comments from the committee? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I had the opportunity to speak to one of the Marine pilots, and it was a really interesting conversation. They're really specialized, and the responsibility that these guys have was just absolutely amazing. And all of the licensing they have to go through to get this, I was really impressed. We're pretty lucky to have something like that, and it's so specialized that you can only do one area, and then you have to know almost every rock in that area. It was really, really interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other comments from the committee members? Seeing none, we will hold this bill. Amendments for this bill are due no later than Wednesday, April 24th at noon, and we will resume this bill that day, I believe, and we will get on to our next item on the agenda. And our third item today is SB 36, Extend the Board of Nursing. Today's our first hearing, and Senator Giesel is here to present the bill. And we are ready for Senator Giesel when she is ready.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. So Senate Bill 36 is a board sunset bill for the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing is scheduled to expire or terminate in June of 2019. This will extend the board for 6 years. Some things you should know about the board. They regulate and promote the protection of health of the citizens of Alaska through the safe and effective practice of nursing. They regulate APRNs, that's Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, Nurse Anesthetists, Registered Nurses, Licensed Practical Nurses, and Certified Nurse Aides. This is the largest board of regulated professionals in the Department of Commerce. There are nearly 20,000 licensees overseen by this board. The other thing you should recognize is that the educational level for these 20,000 folks range from a high school diploma with a community college type degree all the way up to a doctoral degree. So it's an exceedingly diverse group of licensees. The audit that was done, you'll hear about, had four recommendations. And all of those have been agreed to by the board. Several of them are repeats, and we're hoping, of course, that the board will get them identified or get them corrected this time. The Board of Nursing had some difficulty letting the Board of Pharmacy know when APRNs lost their authority to prescribe. That was a procedural issue that the board is going to be correcting. They also have the requirement, and it's a federal requirement, to review the certified nurse aid programs, actually make a site visit to the CNA program and evaluate that educational program. This is interestingly funded by the feds. The board gets about approximately $100,000 a year to fund a contractor to go make these visits. But a few years ago, they lost that contractor and have not refilled that role. I understand that now they actually do have someone on board, but at the time of the audit, they did not. So that, I understand, has already been corrected. There's also an issue in here with complaints and cases being investigated timely. I'm sure you've heard that with a lot of the other regulatory boards. That's not something that's actually in the hands of the board itself. That is a division of business and professional licensing issue that the division is addressing. And there was an issue with the licensed practical nurse not being filled, position not being filled by a licensed practical nurse. So that has been corrected also. One of the things I want to point out, because I suspect you will be interested in it, Mr. Co-Chair, you just asked the other board about that, was the financial status. And if you look on page 11, it does show a deficit for this board, but that is the ending date for that. That number is March of 2018. The nurses renew in October and November of 2018, and so the cash box is full again, Mr. Co-Chair. So with that,
someone's is.
Yes, at least someone's is. So with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux.
So how did you decide on a 6-year renewal,
well,
as opposed to a 3 or a 5 or even the 8-year?
Well, Co-Chair Ledoux, it actually wasn't my recommendation. That was the auditor's recommendation. And they wanted to follow up on these repeat recommendations to make sure that they'd actually been executed this time, I believe. But I think the auditor is online, and she can answer that much more fully than I.
Can we?
We sure can.
Thank you.
And that would be Eileen Donahue. She's not here? Okay. I'm sorry. Getting my auditors mixed up. This would be Karen Bukowski. Yeah, would you like to come forward and speak to the audit? Identify yourself and your affiliation.
For the record, my name is Karen Bukowski, Audit Manager with Division of Legislative Audit. Drew, the chair, to answer your question, the 6-year, the reduction in the extension time was mainly due to the repeat findings, and we had a finding on telehealth as well, which I'll explain when I present the report.
Follow up. So, are you saying that the last time the board was extended, it got the 8-year extension? Because you just said reduced.
Well, there's a maximum of 8 years that we can extend a board in statute. And when I said it reduced, that's what I was referring to.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hammond. Hannon, sorry.
Thank you, through the chair. We've looked at the audit a couple times because we've happened to see all the nurse board seats candidates for review. Mm-hmm. My question has to do with the APRN's prescriptive authority concern that the pharmacy board hadn't previously been noted. And I know that we've had almost a full-scale turnover. 6 of 7 seats on the nursing board have changed over. And so I'm curious as to whether you know the status of meeting that recommendation. I'm not at all opposed to the board being extended, but that was one of those things in the audit that glared at me as something that's probably not as simple as it says in one paragraph in the audit, and concerned that in the transition to a whole new board of nursing virtually being in place, that we've made sure that that concern is addressed. And I don't know if you as an auditor, because that audit is now several months old, whether the department's addressed that, whether that's something you as an auditor could speak to, or whether I should have the department answer that.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe the department could better answer that question. I know that the recommendation is something that will be worked on both by the board and the department.
Do we want to hear from the department, Representative Hannon?
I do, but okay. If you want to finish grilling the auditor, that's fine by me.
Okay.
Should I present
the auditor from the committee? I think we can switch chairs and get the department up here.
Okay.
Sarah Chambers is in the room.
Good afternoon, Madam and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And through the Chair, Representative Hannon, yes, we did make sure that the audit was one of the first things that the new board took a look at and understood, and we made sure that the work that the previous iteration of the board had done on both the DEA Board of Pharmacy notification regulations as well as the telehealth regulations, both of which were recommendations of the auditor, that the previous board's work was placed in front of the current board. And just last week, the current board met and approved two sets of regulations to be forwarded for public notice as soon as they go through the legal process. So we should be able to see those out for public comment in the next couple of weeks.
Follow up.
Through the chair, Ms. Chamber, do you have any sense of how long it'll take? Because that is one that we spend some time in other places talking about an opioid crisis. And so if we've got a professional whose license has been suspended and we didn't notify prescriptive authority, sort of, you know, walking down that train, it seems like it's kind of likely that perhaps that was the reason that their license has been suspended. And it just seems like if we don't make sure that that has been closed and taken care of and addressed, it's really a negligent thing. And so how soon do we think those regs will be in place? And do we think this clears this up so we won't make the same fumble again?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's definitely the auditor's recommendation was definitely a different spin on the way that the board had been looking at their responsibility. There was no responsibility existing. There is no responsibility existing to do that. And so they were looking at it from a perspective that the board issues prescriptive authority. And so when they take it away, the prescriptive authority is gone, and the DEA does their own surveillance across the state. So the auditor's recommendation we see as an extra, not a deficiency, but an extra layer of safeguard, which no one has any problem with. We are already doing that. We've already put administrative measures in place to make sure that that is happening. But the board felt that regulations would just shed some sunlight on it and make sure that it was a mandate on themselves in addition to that administrative extra step.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Chambers? I guess I do, which is based on the fact that the board has been almost entirely switched out, except for one board member who previously was maybe of a year or so experience. I don't know what, maybe you can help me with that. But, and I know 8 years is the maximum. Was there any consideration given to the fact that it was such a new board to maybe revisit in less than 6 years? Or are you, or I don't know who, I guess you. I don't know who makes the recommendation, if it's the auditor or the division. But
seeing as it's there were some repeat sort of issues, and the fact that the board is so green, would that was a consideration to say going less than 6 years?
Mr. Co-Chair, the auditors made the recommendation for 6 years, and the sponsor kept that recommendation. That happened before the board turnover occurred, so it would certainly be up to the will of the legislature to shorten or lengthen that 6 years. But we are keeping a tight watch on the new board. We have lots of new board members, so we're ramping up our training. We're ramping up our assistive steps that we're giving to our board members to make sure that we're at the top of our game so we can help them become at the top of theirs. Okay. I don't anticipate the audit needing to be shortened, but that's certainly up to the legislature to make that determination.
Yeah. And after I asked that question, I realized that the change in the board happened after the audit. So the audit had nothing to do with I understand these things have happened. What was the previous, and maybe this came up already, what were the previous, say, two renewal periods for this board? Was it 6 years each time?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm not certain. I know that the previous was either 7 or 8 years, but before that, I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you.
They're a highly successful board, right. So they tend to get longer extensions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ledoux and then Representative
Fields.
I was
just saying, not as a question, but as a comment, that we also need to keep in mind that we still don't have a permanent, an entirely full board, because one of the nominees didn't meet the requirements.
Thank you. Yes, I don't know when we'll get another name, but I imagine soon. Representative Fields.
I was just going to ask that the department get back to this committee in the appropriate way at the appropriate time regarding review of CNA training programs. That's something that jumped out at me about the audit. So through the chair, I guess I would just like to make that request, and I'd be curious what the time frame would be.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I can certainly give you an update now.
Okay.
If there are additional questions that you have, I'm happy to follow up on those. As the senator mentioned, the time frame of look back for the audit covered a period when we had we were switching from a independent contractor to a permanent position, and that position went vacant for a period of time. We had no responsive contractors. No one responded to the RFP, and then we were unable to find someone for a period of time to fill that role. So the program's approvals fell by the wayside, and the board itself didn't pick up that activity. So when we found the right person and hired for that position, we were able to get back on a schedule, and we've now been on that schedule for a couple of years. And I was at the board's March meeting, the first meeting of this new iteration of the board, and received a very full update on the status of CNA program reviews. So those are fully caught up. We've had someone in that spot for a couple of years now who's doing a fantastic job. So that's no longer a deficiency.
Follow up.
So does that mean that I think it was all 22 programs are getting inspected, if I'm remembering the number correctly?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Fields, they're all being inspected on a biennial basis, and we have a federal grant through Health and Social Services to offset some of the cost to make sure that the CNAs themselves are not bearing the cost of those inspections.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions, comments from the committee? I guess I just want to follow up on that last answer. There's 22 CNA programs currently in the state. Are they mostly affiliated with providers of hospital type places, or are they educational institutes?
Mr. Co-Chair, I can get back to you on that list, but they are a variety. There are some that are private, and there are some that are affiliated with UAA and other university programs. So it really is runs the gamut, and they all have to meet the same standards, which are pretty high, as I learned last week or last month.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Comments? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Chambers.
Thank you.
We will hold this bill. Amendments for this bill are due no later than Wednesday, April 24th at noon also. And our fourth and final item on the agenda today is HB 78, Insurer and Group Insurance Disclosure. And we haven't had a good insurance bill yet, so Lori Wing Heyer, if you can come to the table, introduce yourself and introduce your legislation, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Wing Heyer, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. If I could start by giving a little bit of an overview of why this bill is necessary or why we are asking for this bill at this time. As you can imagine, with a small state, we have limited number of insurers that are actually domiciled here. A lot of the insurance companies that you will see doing business in this state are actually domiciled in Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, and California. However, we do have some domiciled here, and they actually also sell insurance in other states. So the question before my colleagues and I from the various states is, how can we ascertain that all states are meeting the same financial solvency requirements? And accreditation came through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. The model laws that we present to you are vetted at that level, not just with insurance commissioners or directors, but with insurers and other stakeholders, to see that we all agree that if all the jurisdictions adopt the same standards, then an insurance company that comes to Alaska from Pennsylvania or Indiana or Minnesota is meeting the same requirements that I would expect of the insurance companies here. To do that, we adopt the same or similar statutes, and the same with the regulations. Today's bill has two components. One is relatively new to Alaska. Other jurisdictions have adopted, but we've been a little bit late, is corporate governance. And the second part of the bill cleans up a little bit of the language as respecting holding companies. And a holding company, as much as with any other corporation, you can have an entity up top that had several corporations under it. And in insurance, again, to see financial solvency, we'd like to get to the holding company to see where the money is coming from or where the assets are held. And with that, if you'd like me to do a sectional analysis, I'm happy to do so, sir.
Okay. Is the committee ready for an insurance bill sectional? Everyone had coffee? Okay. Ms. Wing Heyer, we are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1, again, this is adding the corporate governance. There is nothing new, really, that we're asking insurance companies to provide to us, except we're asking for them to give us basically a summary of their corporate governance yearly. Right now, we audit insurance companies every 3 years, and we can look for all this and determine that their policies and procedures, members of their board and such, are all in compliance with statute. But now we're asking for them to certify once a year to us that they are meeting those requirements.
What Representative Ledoux?
What exactly is corporate governance?
Corporate governance in this case will be that the board knows the actions of upper management, so that there is not a disconnect between what is or what is taking place in that insurance company. So if there's a merger, an acquisition, a divestiture, if there are financial problems, if there is anything, if they're changing their risk appetite, that the board knows what management is changing or not changing within the company itself.
So that you don't end up with directors who are just asked to be directors because they went to the same school as somebody else who is a director, and then they show up and they don't really do much of anything? That's kind of what you're...
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is exactly the concern, that the board members, the directors and officers of that corporation, know what is taking place within that entity.
Thank you.
Continue.
So the first section again adds in the corporate governance And we have five insurers domiciled in the state of Alaska. We hope to have six soon. They filed for a certificate of authority, so we're hoping to bump that up to six. And what it is doing is requiring the, as you can see in Section B, requires the disclosure to be signed by the CEO or corporate secretary, and again, saying that the board has, the insurer's board, the disclosures have been provided to the insurer's board of the appropriate committee, and that the director may require an insurer to submit a disclosure if the insurer is not already required to do so. The details of the corporate governance will be formed in regulation. It encourages the insurer to make its disclosure at the highest level on specified criteria, so that in the holding company level or at the highest level possible in that company, so that we know that the decisions that are happening in that company are up to the top upper management, but also again that the board knows, and requires that the disclosures are to be reviewed and any requests for information are to be made through the lead state, which in Alaska of course would be us, and in accordance with the NAIC Financial Analysis Handbook. This 2109-334 will allow us to adopt regulations for this, and 2109-336 will set out the contents of the annual disclosure that we will ask the insurers to comply with. 2109-338 will have confidentiality, which is in our statutes already.
We have a question, Representative Ledoux.
So did the NAIC just come up with this idea fairly recently?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I would like to tell you that they did, because it would save me the embarrassment to say no. It has been around for about 4 or 5 years. All states are required to have this to keep our accreditation by 2020, January 1st, 2020. So we are one of the last states to adopt this.
Follow up, Representative Ledoux.
Any particular reason why you're bringing it to us now rather than last year or the year before?
Yes, ma'am.
The year before that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this bill and the second part of it actually did come up last year. There was a four-part accreditation bill. There were some changes in one of the sections, and by the time the changes were adopted and came back to committee, we were asked to drop these two final pieces of that bill, Section 3 and 4, to pass Sections 1 and 2.
Gotcha.
So it was simply because of the timing. The committee at that time did not think that they had enough time to go through 3 and 4 because there was a considerable amount of time spent on the first part of the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
So what would the real-world impact of not passing this bill be?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I can't tell you that we'd lose accreditation, which is the NAIC and peers coming in to say that we conform with what other states are doing. We're accredited every 5 years. We went through accreditation in 2017 and passed with flying colors, but they could put us on a probation.
And follow-up.
Follow-up.
Would it also potentially force Alaska-based insurers to domicile elsewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, it could. One of the purposes of having all states conform to similar legislation and processes on this is that when I go do, or my staff does, an examination of an insurer that's domiciled here, they pay for it. We charge them for any consultants, our time, and what it costs to perform that examination. Now, you can imagine if I couldn't certify that examination and 26 states had to come in, examine the same set of books, the cost to that insurance company. And it would be, in some cases, it'd be insurmountable. So in having the accreditation, they pay once, they pay the state of Alaska for the examination, and then they're accredited to go do or to conduct transact insurance in other states.
Okay. So final follow-up, if I understand this correctly, we could, by failing to pass this bill, hypothetically, we could force local companies to domicile elsewhere, which would seem to be absurd just to maintain insurance coverage here, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux?
You've already answered my question in that soliloquy.
I have a question. I guess when you say accreditation, is that the state becomes accredited? And can you go over accreditation specifically?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, the state is accredited. And every 5 years, we submit to the NAIC, and they have outside consultants and peers that come in and look at not only our statutes and our regulations. They look at my staff and their credentialing. They look at the exams we have conducted in previous years, and they rank us. Did we pass or fail? It's an every five-year process. The last one we did was in 2017, and we passed with flying colors. But it's not to say that, you know, every state has the same luck we do. Keeping insurance staff sometimes is tiring. I mean, it's just it's hard. But we're very fortunate in the staff we have.
So following up on that, if the state was accredited, that would mean that the NAIC would have approved of our statutes and regulations and your staff, et cetera. But how would that affect the domicile status or the ability for the companies domiciled here to conduct business elsewhere that this bill is going to solve any problems for?
Mr. Chairman, when the state is accredited, then our work is accepted by the other 49 states and the District of Columbia. If we lose our accreditation, then each state has to show or prove to themselves that our insurance company are meeting all the financial solvency requirements that they have adopted in that particular state.
So adopting this statute will further guarantee that we'll be accredited in 2022. Is that correct? And then if they look at our laws and say, well, you guys really should be on board with the issues in this bill, then they may not give us accreditation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions that I see? Nope. Representative Ledoux.
Do we have to adopt exactly the same language as this model? Do we have any leeway, or is it one of these kinds of things from the National Association that it's kind of like take it or leave it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in accreditation, we have to adopt substantially similar. So you will see some of the drafting covenants do not match the model law exactly. Now, other laws or statutes that may be brought forward from the NAIC through the same vetting process, such as licensing, it's a take it or leave it. We don't have to adopt them. Accreditation, we all agree that we will adopt the model law or substantially similar language.
Thank you.
So how many other states, you say we're one of the last ones to adopt this language, and did they give you any indication if you don't do this, the next time accreditation comes up, you may have some problems? Do they indicate those kind of things?
Mr. Chairman, in June we have to send what we call an interim report that where we are on legislation that is to be effective in 2020. And at that point, I would have to notify them, assuming we're out of session and if the bill had not passed, that I did not get this model law enacted. And then we would have to see what happened from that point.
Okay, thank you. So the clock is ticking. Do you want to continue on your sectional analysis?
Getting down to 2109.342 establishes the penalties for an insurer that fails to comply. Quite honestly, I can't imagine that we would ever need $1,000 a day for that length of time. But that is the end of the corporate disclosure. We would be issuing regulations for this, putting it more specific exactly what the disclosure needs to be. But again, that is also a model that has been vetted at the NAIC level. We would adopt substantially similar in that regulation. The next part is, and these are amendments now to holding company. You have previously seen holding company legislation and adopted statutes to it. And again, in looking at financial solvency, this is a letting us get to the parent, the highest parent in a corporation, so that we can see where the money's coming from, or if there were to be claims in the state of Alaska, how are they going to get paid to our consumers? And the first part, it's quite a lengthy process, but what it's doing is changing the term from the previous year to December 31st. If an insurance company were to decide to liquidate some assets, if they were to merge, if they were to acquire a new company or divest of a company, this is saying that they have to look to advise us, which they already have to do in statute. What we're changing is that if it's more than 3% or what the formula is for the various insurers, that it has to be based on the preceding December 31st calendar year as opposed to the current year. If an insurance company were to come and say we're doing X in the month of March, that year would not give me an accurate picture of the impact that that's going to have on that company. So we're backing up to the previous calendar year and say, show us the impact this transaction would have on the overall structure of the insurer.
Representative Ledoux.
I don't get it. Why a current, they, I mean, doing it based upon the current year would be less meaningful than doing it on the past year.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, because in the current year we may only be 4 months into it, whereas we go to the year previous or the prior year, then we're going to see the impact on 12 months of business as opposed to 4 months of business when you look at their revenues or their revenue stream. So it lets us see it. They've just closed a year, their financial statements are out, they've issued their annual report, now they want a transaction. What is that going to do to that insurance company? What impact is it going to have on it? And if we do it mid-year, it's not giving us the time to really see, or the data to really see what it's going to do.
Okay, thank you.
The bill also in Section 3 allows for confidentiality, which again is already provided in statute, but we reiterate it in this section. Section 4 is clarifying that the information we get, and you know, and I don't like to refer to this as business trade secrets, but there we do get data that any business would not want to release to the public, such as if they were looking at buying another company, or if they were thinking of selling to another company, or different things that you would want to keep close until the transaction were actually occurring and you could go public with it. And what this says is the director or my staff or consultants that we might bring on board, including the NAIC if we were to need them, could not be held to have to release that information that we're considering confidential.
Representative Ledoux.
So that means you couldn't release it even if there were a subpoena for it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is my understanding. We could talk about anything else in the company, including their marketing, their business practices, but the specific information held at a financial disclosure, we could not discuss that particular piece.
Just follow up. So how would that work if the subpoena were issued by a federal court as opposed to a state court? Would there be like a preemption issue or something like that maybe?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I will have to get back to the committee on that, but my assumption is yes, because most of this has also gone through the Federal Insurance Office for clarification when this has been vetted, that it would not, again, it'd be considered proprietary at that point. We would not release it. We could talk to anything else on the company except this particular, the financial disclosures that are given to us in the confidentiality or in the holding company in the examinations.
Thank you. If you would get back to me, I'd really appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So, Ms. Winghart, because this is a new section, so what is it, what currently would be the case if you received a subpoena about documents that you had deemed a confidential nature in a civil action against an insurer?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we have very stringent, it's already in our statute to hold these documents confidential. Much of the financial documents that we receive from the insurance company are held confidential, including our exam work papers and such, and the final examination. What this is being added for is because of the holding company. We have not had statutes that clarify that the holding company would be subject to the same, I don't want to say benefit, but the same confidentiality as the companies underneath it.
Follow up,
just so I'm clear in my mind. So right now you already have to meet this confidentiality. And, I mean, the part that glares out is that even if you were subpoenaed to testify they had the money to pay them off in a civil action suit,
You couldn't say, yep, they got the $2 million in the bank, they're just not going to pay you for it. But if it was the full corporation, you would have to keep that confidential. But if it was a holding company, we don't, because we don't address holding companies currently. And this extends that to the holding companies.
Through the chair, Representative Hammond, we do. We have a whole chapter on holding companies. But this is a new subsection to that, okay, addressing the confidentiality.
Representative Ledoux.
So just following up on that right now, you're putting this in now, addressing the holding companies. And right now, this is not law. So what happens if you get a subpoena right now asking for information from a holding company? What do you do?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, my attorneys would tell me that 210906 is going to, I believe is the statute, is going to extend to that case if we had a subpoena. I am quite sure that's what they would tell me. The authority I already have would extend to that as well. But it's not specifically in the holding company, but that would be their argument, is that we already have the confidentiality written into statute.
But this just sort of seals it.
Through the chair, again, Representative Ledoux, both of these, Section 1 and, if you will, and Section 2 of this bill, both restate the confidentiality. Section 5 is also new, and this throws an even further wrinkle in how we look at things. Now, I want to be honest and tell you, in the state of Alaska, we do not have any internationally active companies that are domiciled here. But in the event we do, this is part of the model law, and we're asking to adopt it at this time. And this, again, talks about if, just for one of our domiciled companies is ARECA, the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Let's just say, for an example, that they were bought by Munich Re, who's out of, as you might guess, Europe. This would allow us to still see who would be the supervisor or the examiner or who would be responsible for that insurance company if it were held by an international parent. And the section talks about naming a supervisor and who would be best qualified. Would it be where they're domiciled, or where they write the majority of their business? And it gives a test to determine if there were to be an examination of that company, which there has to be, who would be the one to do it. And it's, again, I can't see where this will ever come into play in Alaska, but the world is changing every day. And as we look at Alaska being the crossroads between Europe and Asia, perhaps someday we will have an international insurance company here. Section 6 adds two definitions for, again, an internationally active insurance company and a group-wide supervisor. Section 7 allows me to adopt regulations, and 8 provides for an effective date.
Any questions? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. And I want to just go back. You said 2020 is when the state needs to be in compliance. And then you said at a point in questioning that in June you have to report what's our status. June of this year, 2019, we have to report that we've got a bill in that meets, right now the language matches the model language, and we're passed it through one body.
Through the chair, Representative Hammond, that is exactly correct. Every June we file a report as to where we are on any bills that need to be passed, that impact accreditation, as well as examinations where we might be in the middle of an exam, so that other states can see that we do take this seriously and are trying to be in compliance.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Winghire. We made it through our first insurance bill of the year, and we will get back to this bill. We're holding it for now, but we will get back to it soon. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. And that concludes our meeting for today. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, April 24th at 3:15. We are adjourned at 4:13.